Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Philosophy for Our Times, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of Art and Ideas. In this week's episode, we're looking at the science behind monogamous relationships and asking the question, have we as a species evolved beyond them? Here to debate the issue is author, journalist and broadcaster Helen Croydon.
I think actually monogamy is unrealistic.
Relationship psychologist Susan Quilliam.
At heart, we all want somebody to rely on. I think we're drawn to monogamy even if we get sometimes distracted.
And anthropologist Kit Opie.
Primates are essentially relationship animals.
Robert Roland Smith hosts.
Clearly, whatever else goes on in the experience of love and falling in love, it is, there's a certain kind of deliciousness to it. And I guess, the first question we're going to go into is, you know, whether love does actually complete us. I wanted to ask you, Helen, whether the other forms of deliciousness, whether riding horses or whatever it might be, are they really comparable? Because, I mean, I got the sense, and I'm saying this slightly to provoke you, that, you know, love is just one of many, you know, pleasures that we might indulge in, but there's nothing special or particularly delicious about that kind. So how would you answer that? Isn't that the best form of completion that there is?
I definitely, you know, love is probably the deepest form because it's so powerful, because there are powerful hormones at bay. And I write a lot in my book about the chemical dopamine having this role when we fancy someone and you go, it makes you literally quite loopy. And these experiments have been done on couples that have gone in brains, couples who are newly in love, or even just if you have a crush on someone, you know, that we're all familiar with that feeling, aren't we? Those like fervent feelings. And when these either individuals with a crush or couples in the honeymoon phase of romance go into a brain scanner and their brains light up with the same parts of their brain light up as a coke addict would if they're craving their drugs. So really, when we're fancying someone or when we're in that early stage of romance, we are actually just acting like a crack addict. So that's dangerous because that is not a natural and persistent state. It is also dangerous because it dilutes our achievements to date and the things which really make us fundamentally, the more stable forces that make us happy. Small things like how we want our house to be, how often we want to see our friends, all those things that we've created in our life, and to then base your fulfillment on meeting someone and on merging your life with someone, I think that actually doesn't do justice to the things that we've individually made our personal forms of commitment.
Thank you. Is that where the notion of vocation comes in too, then? The idea of, you know, you don't necessarily have to choose one thing or another, but you must choose the thing by which you are called.
Yes, I think so. I mean, what was coming up when Helen was talking was that there's been a deep belief in marital therapy, or partnership therapy, over the last 100 years. To say that, yeah, indeed, love does complete us, that by finding a partner, we come together and we find our twin. The latest ideas are saying that that is dangerous, as you said, because if we say that we are dependent on somebody else for completion, then the whole thing becomes very demanding, and we need that other person to fulfill our every need, and we need to make sure that we fulfill their needs, otherwise we are disappointed. The latest ideas are suggesting that it's not a case of we lean on each other and we are complete. It's we are individuals, and to support each other and to be maybe sometimes more fulfilled, we lean in. But to lean in too heavily and to expect completion of ourselves to our partner, is actually a real trap.
Well, I'm going to pick a little bit of a fight with you here.
Please do.
Because, I mean, you began by talking about, you know, your generation, your mother's generation, and society has changed a lot, and, you know, choices available to you now weren't necessarily available before. Well, what if I sort of turn the same argument back on you and say, well, Susan, you know, you're talking all about the individual here. You're just subscribing to a new doctrine of individualism here, just because that's where the world is now. So why is what you're saying just another a sort of advert for self-interest?
When I first talked about vocation, I was talking about, do you thrive? But I also added immediately afterwards, and does your partner thrive? And I think I said, correct me if I'm wrong, that does society thrive by the contribution we make? So no, it's much wider than self-interest.
Okay. It struck me listening to you that actually there's no space at all in what you said for love at all. You're not talking about love, you're talking about evolution, evolutionary choices, functional needs, evolutionary moves that we've made, and chemical substances. But it seems to me there's no room at all in what you described for love. So the question, does love complete us, is sort of, doesn't it really come into your worldview at all? Because it would be superfluous.
Well, I mean, I was going to take Helen up on what she was saying about, you know, these drug-induced falling in love as being unnatural. It is the most natural thing. The way that evolution has found as the best way to ensure that individuals pass on their genes into the next generation. Primates also are essentially relationship animals. We only exist in relationship. So the very earliest primates, 75 million years ago, were individuals. They lived on their own. They only came together to mate, a typical mammal way of doing things. But primates in the main then switched. They became social. And they only exist as part of a society, small scale for many primates and much larger for us, but we only exist in relation to the other people around us. But I think it may be seen as kind of evolutionary and functional and so on, but our purpose here is really about passing on our genes. That's why we're here. We have 4 billion years of history getting us to this point, which has always been about passing on genes to the next generation. And I think that's where actually we find fulfillment, is in passing on to the next generation. And we can choose, you know, all sorts of different ways of doing that. But if we do that with, as I say, someone that we love, someone that we want to do that job with, then I think it has something special.
So what do we think? Are we bound to be monogamous, really, and you're kicking against that?
I don't think we're bound to be monogamous. I think there are already a whole variety of choices. You know, the figures on infidelity show that. I think that at heart, we all want somebody to rely on. I think we're drawn to monogamy, even if we get sometimes distracted. And I work therapeutically with clients, and very often the most pain is brought either because a relationship is failing or because a relationship is surviving, but only at the cost of one or the other partner having other partners. I'm not saying monogamy is best, because I think we all are now in a position to make our own choices, but I think there's something deep inside us that wants to turn to a partner and say, will you be there for me? Can I rely on you? And that's maybe something that can only be done in a monogamous relationship.
Mm. What are you thinking?
Well, I think when we're in that, sorry if I keep referring back to this early honeymoon phase of romance, but I think it's very important to make the distinction between like long-term love and early honeymoon romance, because I think they are entirely different, and we tend to, when we talk about relationships, we tend to think of them as one and the same, because we sort of want, we want like both in one. We want to feel love and long-term love and devotion for someone, but we also want the butterflies. And I think actually we perhaps need to adjust our thinking or adjust our perspective on relationships, to think of them almost as two different things. So when you're in that early honeymoon phase of romance, most of us only have eyes for that person. So in that respect, monogamy is natural, I think, because I think it's very natural, unless you are some egotistical maniac that just can't get rid of Tinder on your phone. I think most people, when they are genuinely falling in love with someone, they are just sexually into that person. However, when the problems start happening and when the battles happen, it tends to be after several years. And that's when I think actually monogamy is unrealistic. We don't want it to be, because we still want to be with one person. We want to be loved and we want to love. But you only have to look at the evidence across history. And particularly now, I think the reason why it's such a bigger problem now, it's not so much the sexual monogamy, it's the social monogamy, in that can one person meet all your needs? And why that is such a bigger challenge now is down to a number of things. Firstly, we are more independent generally. We have the younger generation now, anyone from like 40s downwards has probably lived away from home before they've even contemplated marriage. They've lived with flatmates. They form their own patterns and habits. The second thing is we are just much more transient. We don't stay in jobs for as long as we used to. We travel around more. We go travelling. We have aeroplanes that can get us to the other side of the world in less than 24 hours. And the other thing is we have the internet, which has just made it so easy to form new social groups. And I'm not just talking about making it easier to meet new people online in a dating context. I'm meaning just opening up a very niche social group. The reason that's relevant is because it's making loneliness less of an issue, I think, or social contact is now less of a problem. So we need relationships less than we used to. And it's those three things, those three key changes in society, the fact that we're more independent, we're more transient, and we have the internet has allowed more social reach, that has made relationships more fickle because we don't actually need them as much.
And I wonder if, in a way, you're leaving the door open for an argument for serial monogamy, actually. I mean,
definitely.
If that is...
I think we are actually, as humans, we're not designed for lifelong monogamy. I think we are designed for monogamy, but a series of long-term relationships.
Why would that not be compatible with what you're saying, or is it?
I think it actually is. Hunter-gatherers, the way in which humans lived for 95% of our evolutionary history, live exactly like that. So relationships are much looser than we currently conceive of until now, and are not necessarily for life. So women have a lot more power in those societies. There is a lot more equality, which is what I think we're starting to experience in our society. I think we also have to consider the challenges to the current welfare state, for example. I mean, in the pre-welfare state, being in a relationship perhaps wasn't so much about love. It was more like an insurance policy. I mean, if you were likely to get old on your own, then you would die very early and probably quite horribly. And if we're moving to a situation where, you know, currently the welfare state is challenged, we know all the difficulties about looking after elderly people and so on, then, you know, we want to spend our life in a way that also means that we have a long and happy life right until the end. And to fill that with people who might provide some kind of care. And I think, you know, the best candidates for that are someone that we're in a relationship with and our children. They're probably the very best people to look out for us as we get old.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to iai.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
I want to ask Susan as well, particularly about this question of serial monogamy, because I assume, without giving any confidences away, that in your kind of psychotherapeutic work, it's a subject that crops up. So can you just tell us a bit on, you know, whether that appears to be a satisfactory model for people or not?
I think sometimes it's satisfactory, sometimes it's not. Certainly, while the expectation up to the middle years of the 20th century was one relationship. I mean, my grandfather had five children, and then his wife died at 26 in childbirth. He never married again. My parents were married for 40 years. They didn't expect to have relationships within that. Nowadays, the average is about five major committed relationships. I'm not going to go into what committed means, but there's a big, important relationship end of teens at school. There's another usually live-in relationship during the 20s that can blend into or can be left for a parenting relationship in the late 20s through to the 30s. 40s, first divorce, new relationship. And then the later life relationship for often companionship, but actually companionship with a vocational aspect, you know, that people in the later life are going to thrive in relationship and they're giving as well as taking. So yeah, five, I'm not saying there aren't other relationships around that, but five serious relationships.
You've got a lot to look forward to.
Yes, we have.
Well, this kind of moves us on actually to the final kind of the three questions, which is about alternatives to monogamy. And maybe we'll just pick up exactly where you were there, Susan. So, and again, if you think about some of the clients you work with and the kind of stories you hear, what's the question here? I guess the question is, what sort of variety of relationships do you see? How much are those driven by what you're sort of implying there, demographic changes? How much are they sort of conscious choices, and are people happy?
I think there's a hugely bigger variety than there were, because we have more choice, and because if you have a relationship, it isn't necessarily going to end in having children together, willingly or unwillingly, and therefore it's possible to separate and move on. So I think there's a bigger variety. I'm not sure that people are happier. I hate to disagree with Helen, who is a long-time colleague, but I think people have not left loneliness behind. I think that we, you know, that the whole flux in society, the fact that we can have divorce, puts an essential insecurity into relationships. So there can be, I wouldn't put it as strongly as desperation, but there can be a deep need, which maybe there wasn't in smaller societies without the flexibility and without the internet. But yeah, no, hugely bigger variety. I'm not sure that's solving the problem.
What about open relationships? How many of those do you see and how successful are those?
There's two sorts of open relationship. There's a relationship where A wants an open relationship and B agrees to that. And there's the relationship where both A and B want an open relationship and they make it work. I think the first one is doomed. I think the second one can work. And I see more examples of that. I still think there is somewhere in there a need to have a person that one can rely on. And maybe that's met by more than one person in different contexts. Maybe it's met by one person.
What about you? Does your theory account for open relationships or not?
Yeah, but I think we've got to be very wide on the label of this. So I've researched a lot of alternative relationship models, modern models of relationship. That was exact thing I wanted to look at with my book, because I wanted to question what sort of relationship do I want. So interview loads of people in all sorts of different models. And open relationship is, we have this view of it that it means that, you know, you can sleep around or people have different partners. Actually, it could mean a lot of things. It could mean simply that you are in a committed relationship or marriage, and after a certain, you just give each other a holiday. That I spoke to one guy who said that he was in a marriage, he was faithful the whole time, and he said he was fantasizing about women, because he stayed faithful and wanted to stay faithful, but it was driving him mad. He was fantasizing about loads of women, and he said one day, can we just have a holiday? And it wasn't then that they entered an open relationship. They just decided to experiment one day and have a holiday. But I guess that is a form of open relationships.
What was it? Tell us about the holiday. What was involved in the holiday? get on a plane as
get
well?
Get the book, it's in it. But I think, you know, the point is we can define relationships how we want. We don't even have to call it an open relationship. We don't even have to call ourselves swingers or polyamorists or all these other labels that we have. I think we're in a modern world now, in a modern culture, where we are able to, and we have to, define a relationship in a way that suits us. So personally, I've now reached a conclusion where I think I do want a long-term relationship. And, you know, after years and years of writing books called Screw the Fairy Tale and saying, I don't want that, I think I do. But what terrifies me is this idea that, am I still going to feel passionate about something after someone after like 5-6 years? So rather than being scared by that, I think we should all just be open to the idea that perhaps you can either, you know, a holiday is one solution or what I'm saying is there's a myriad of possibilities that most of us don't think about or don't dare to think about. I don't think it puts us into a box of swingers and open relationships if we do dare to experiment with those things.
Let me ask you a very old-fashioned question then in response to that. Are there no moral parameters around any of that?
Honesty is the biggest. Promiscuity itself or sex with multiple people itself, I don't think is a moral issue as long as you're being honest with those people and you're not manipulating people's hearts and you're being safe from a physical point of view. I think the morality comes in how honest you're being with your partner. And likewise, I think if you can communicate to your partner that, yeah, I'm really scared of monogamy, or actually, I am having fantasy. I still like you, I still fancy you, but hey, I'm having fantasies about other people. I think a real healthy relationship, you should be able to talk about that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I wanted to pick up on this with you, Kit, because in a way, you know, we're talking about rapidly changing social practices, particularly in this part of the world, and I know it's not by any means universal. You know, we're in a particularly liberal part of the world and a liberal part of a liberal part of the world here. So how do we kind of work with those two time zones? Because we're in an evolutionary time zone at the same time, which obviously has a very different pace to it, doesn't it? So how do you correlate those two things, you know, what Helen's describing with the kind of timeline that you put on changes?
Well, I want to bring a note of caution, because I don't think we can escape our evolutionary past. We are, you know, Darwinian animals, and it's all very well to say that, you know, we have choices, we can do what we like. We need to look at the facts. And if we look at what happens to children in households where the biological father is no longer resident, then those children are up to 40 times more likely to experience some kind of abuse, leading potentially up to infanticide. And we all know the cases like Baby P, who then turned out to be Baby Paul. And then there were interviews with Baby Paul's father, who said, if only I'd known, I would have done something about it. And I think that's a really key point. Because monogamy is there on the basis that it is a protection against infanticide amongst all large-brained primates, of which we are one, then we can't move completely away from it thinking that there's not going to be any backlash. There is going to be a backlash, and it's going to hit children. And that doesn't mean that, you know, couples need to stick together through thick and thin, even if they hate each other. If we're going to have, you know, maybe these 5 serial monogamy relationships, men in particular need to know that they need to stay in touch, they need to have full and proper relationships with their children, and they need to not have complete blowouts with their ex that make it impossible for them to continue having relationships with those kids. I mean, even if there is actually no physical abuse of those children, there's also evidence that, you know, they do worse at school, they have more difficulty with relationships afterwards. So I'm very happy that people kind of talk about all the possibilities and all the different relationships that they can possibly get into. But remember why we have monogamy in the first place.
Thank you. Thanks very much. We've had a very broad-ranging discussion already. You know, we've talked about vocation, we talked about cherries on the cake, you know, individual choices, monogamy, infanticide, different ways of sort of navigating the world that we're in. Please show your appreciation for our panel.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast, brought to you by the Institute of Art and Ideas. So what do you think? Is monogamy dead, or do monogamous relationships serve our biological interests? Let us know by tweeting at II_TV with the hashtag Philosophy for Our Times.